to the man behind the curtains. Heard that somewhere before. It's good to see you all. Happy Sabbath. I was putting together the message for this week. The last couple days I had the chance to be on the road, and it seemed like a timely message, especially after I looked in the mirror today and the veins had finally gone down from my forehead, driving on the interstate. And I think everyone who doesn't really have a license was on the interstate with me. Or they shouldn't maybe have a license. And I thought I'd overcome all of that rage. Or maybe it's not rage, but still, just frustration. But anyway, it's good to be here, and that does actually have something to do with my message today. But we'll start out talking about just over a century ago or so, a couple of brothers in North Carolina got the first airplane off the ground. You remember the Wright brothers? And can you imagine at that point if they were to come back today and realize the technology that had changed since that time? The fact that we've had men on the moon, the fact that we have a robot up on Mars that's taking all these high-quality pictures, sending them back to us. There's been incredible technology changes. Medical science has made unfathomable strides in dealing with human diseases and injuries. We understand that many people now live longer than they would have in the past. They have died many years ago because of these medical advances. In economically advantaged nations like the United States and others, we take for granted things like the automobile, things like air flight, things like television, things like running water, things like electricity or computers. Yet if you look back at the last century, in spite of all this wonderful scientific advances, all of these advances that we've made, you would think, as a culture, we also have some very dark spots in that last century. Things like Auschwitz and all of the terrible things that happened in World War II and the other atrocities that have happened in the last century, you know, as far as war-related. We've had communism and the totalitarianism where they killed millions of people. We've seen the rise of terrorism again in the name of religion and terrible things like 9/11 and just terrible things that we hear about in the news every day, things happening. We've seen technology used as a tool for ungodly rule. But if you ask a Christian or a Christianity in general, it will rightly claim that every person has value and that every person is a creation of God's. And that's very true. But many ask themselves, why do people do such terrible things? Why do they do such heinous crimes? They said, we know that God didn't create people evil. And we know that. We understand that. We could go back if we wanted to spend the time to Genesis and clearly see that Adam and Eve, those first humans that were created, initially displayed no evil thoughts, no evil actions. We could look back and we could read and see that they lived in harmony with their Creator and with each other. Our Bible shows us that human beings were made in the image of God and in His likeness. And this is the very reason that we all have the ability to love and to reason and to feel and express pretty complex emotions. You see, God gave us this incredible ability. But He also gave us something else. You see, along with reasoning and the capacity to look at information and facts and draw conclusions, along with that comes the power to choose. And every day, all of us make hundreds of informed decisions. And you know, from very basic things to things that are a little bit more involved. But we decide what to wear each day, depending on what the weather's going to be and what we're going to be doing. We decide what we're going to have for lunch today or who we might have lunch with. We decide what projects are going to get priority today. This is what I want to accomplish. We also decide on what thoughts we're going to consider and which ones we're going to discard, which ones we're going to dwell on, and which ones we're going to act on. We decide how we're going to deal with our emotions and what actions they're going to take and how we react to others. You see, we need to understand that in this way, human beings have the capacity to choose between good and evil. We can choose to control our anger, and I could just give that guy the dirty look who cut me off, or I could run into him, or I could say, please God, forgive me, or help him drive better or whatever. See, we can choose to control our anger or we can choose to act out on it. The issue of choice is a complex human behavior. But the freedom of choice, again, understands why human beings can be bad and good. So I want to ask you, though, why would anyone choose evil? We need to remember that we are born with few inherent instincts, but one of them is self-preservation. Self-preservation. Also, Mr. Ramo and I were talking before. He said, you know, how when many of us are born, we have to learn everything except that whole self-centered thing, the mind part. We got that down from right when we're born, right? We need to work on overcoming that. But if we look at self-preservation, that's one of the things that we are born with inherently. And as a race, if we didn't have that inherent will to survive, we would have died out years ago. But with that also comes the fact that we want to avoid unpleasant experiences, right? None of us want to feel any physical pain or feel hungry or feel cold or any discomfort. We just don't like it, right? We don't want that. No one wants to feel emotionally rejected or to feel worthless. We want to feel good. There's nothing wrong with that. Every one of us has a desire to please our five senses. And again, inherently, there's nothing wrong with that. But this instinct for self-preservation, the need for food and for shelter, and the desires to please the senses, isn't necessarily, again, good or evil. It's just a necessity. What the issue is how we choose to fulfill those desires that can be good or bad. To me, what it really boils down to is how much we're motivated by self-centeredness or selfishness. The it's all about me syndrome. How much do you think in your life do you have that it's all about me? I think you'll see by the end of this message that it's something that all of us, again, we're born with. It's something that we work to overcome, and there are times when we're better at it than others. There are times when we let our own wants or desires maybe lead us in a direction that we don't want to go. You see, selfishness is at the root of many evil things, and we'll see that as we work through the message. But let's look at reality for a minute. Because of the intensity of our instinct to self-preserve, to keep going, to not experience pain, to our desire to fulfill our senses, each of us tends to kind of, maybe it's not a conscious thing, but we kind of are the center of, I don't want to say of the universe, but it is about us to a degree because we react to how things affect us. And we see everything going on around us. So we tend to see ourselves as that center piece, right? The key is how much we succumb to the selfish part of it, the unbridled selfishness. When we stop trying to serve others, when we start thinking of ourselves too much, that's when our choices can be damaging. We can look at some obvious examples, and we will, in modern times, where evil selfishness has wreaked havoc on others. We could go through a list of leaders in our world and see just some of the complete atrocities that they've let their people be succumbed to. You know, some of the and we won't even go through names, but look at, you know, some of the ones that we think of: Stalin and the millions of people that were killed, Hitler, Saddam Hussein. Just so many people that inflicted so much damage on people to build themselves up. Just last night I heard on the news about the doctor in, I don't know where he was from, not far from here, that charged the government $35 million, I think, for cancer treatments that he never gave people. He said he was, but he wasn't. And it was only to get rich, to buy the boat, to buy the houses, to buy whatever. We can see that going on around us, but it's much harder, I think, at times to come to grips with the selfishness that lies within each of us at times. And the more that we focus on our selfish desires, the less we're able to recognize or understand our own faults, our own shortcomings, because we just get involved in our own little world, our own little cocoon, and everything affects us. And again, it happens to all of us at times, and something that we all have to fight. But we have to understand that the more that a person is controlled by selfishness, and again, we all are at times, the more the person shifts responsibilities for his or her actions to others. And again, it's a trap that we could all fall into. What I'm saying is that we are all basically self-centered. And whether we realize it or not, we live our days like it's all about us. That's just the way it is. Many of us, or I should say many of the sins that we are caught by and that we repent of and that we keep struggling with at times are brought on because we have sometimes an overwhelming urge to please ourselves and to please our desires. We wrestle with something. I know I shouldn't do it, but you do it, and then you're sorry, you repent. But it's that desire to please yourself that causes that sometimes. Romans 3:23 tells us that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. We know that verse. We also know that God has the only solution to the problem, and we need only to tap into that and to let Him work with us and to listen to Him. Before we start talking about specific areas of where we're self-centered, turn over to 1 Kings 21. We'll look at an example that we've looked at a few times here. But again, I think it's a classic. It's a story that we know. And again, it just sets the stage for the topic today. It's a classic example of selfishness and its evil consequences. 1 Kings 21. We're going to see this story that this selfishness or really, lust in this case brought on terrible results. This lust for power, this lust for wealth, this lust for what I want often and usually brings about all kinds of curses. You remember here in 1 Kings 21 the story of Naboth's vineyard. And I guess to set the stage, you got to think about it. If you've ever grown grapevines, I'm talking about a vineyard, but even a grapevine, you don't just plant it like you do some corn, and this year you have grapes. It takes work. It takes a lot of cultivating. It takes a lot of pruning. It takes a lot of nurturing to eventually have a productive grapevine. Magnify that times the thousands of plants on a vineyard, and you understand that there's a lot of work that goes in. It's not just, again, I want to grow some tomatoes, I put in some seeds, I grow it, give a little water, ooh, I have tomatoes. There's work involved. It takes a lot of diligence over a long period of time to produce a first-rate crop of wine. And Naboth here apparently had a vineyard like that. Let's look at starting in verse 1. It says, now it came to pass after these things, Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. Now, some commentators will say it was right up next against the palace wall. And others will say it was at least adjoined Ahab's property. But it doesn't matter which one it was. Ahab owned the property. Verse 2. And Ahab spoke to Naboth. I'm sorry, Naboth owned the vineyard. Ahab wanted it. And Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, "Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a garden of herbs." So he says something. It's not bad. You see a piece of property that you want, you go and you make an offer, right? "I'd like to have this. I want to build a house. I want to do whatever." So, but he's saying, I want to basically put in a vegetable garden here. I don't really want your vineyard. I want to plant something here that I can use. And here's a man, again, he's talking to Naboth, whose father probably had lived on this land and cultivated it, maybe his grandfather. So it had been in his family for a long time, maybe possibly several generations. And so there's probably no way that he's going to say, "Oh, sure, give me a piece of land, I'll start over again. You can have it." That wasn't going to happen. Verse 3, and so Naboth said to Ahab, "You know, the Lord forbid it to me that I should give my inheritance, the inheritance of my fathers, to you." So he's saying in a nice way, "Not a chance. Sorry, go look elsewhere." Verse 4, and Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." And he lay down upon his bed, and he turned his face away, and he would eat no bread. I can just envision this, you know. He's laying there pouting because this guy would not do what he wanted, you know. It's what it boils down to. But notice again as we look on here, the slyness of his wife. Really, we understand, if we understand the whole story of Ahab and Jezebel, she was really the power behind the throne, and people knew it. If Jezebel said something, that's what they did. Verse 5, but Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said, "Why is your spirit so sad that you eat no bread?" When, you know, I can think of it as me, I'd be saying, "Knock it off. Grow up. You're the king. Act like an adult." Verse 6, and he said to her, "Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, 'Give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it pleases you, I will give you another vineyard for it.' And he answered, 'I will not give you my vineyard.' And Jezebel, his wife, said to him, 'Do you now govern the kingdom of Israel?'" So she's not really helping at this point. She's not being supportive. "Aren't you the king? Don't you have the power? Don't you know how to handle the situation? You just sit there and you mope. You're the king. Do something about it." She says, "Arise, eat bread, and let your heart be merry. And I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." You see, this lust for his property, this selfishness for his property, is very, very strong at this point. And selfishness, again, we might say, breeds lust for that. We could say it goes either way. But again, lying and stealing, as we'll see in this case, and eventually murder, are the end results of this selfishness, this lust for his property. Verse 8, and so she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles that were in the city dwelling in Naboth. Now, do you think for a minute they actually thought these letters were from Ahab? They knew who they were from. Not a chance. They knew who wanted this done, and they knew that if they didn't carry it out, that their necks were probably on the line as well. Verse 9, and she wrote in the letters, saying, "Proclaim a fast." You remember the story, right? They had a big party. They said, you know, say what a great guy Naboth is. And then two people are supposed to say, you know, "We heard him curse God." And of course, then he would be accused. He would be stoned. Drop down to verse 11. And the men of the city, even the elders and nobles who were were the inhabitants in this city, did as Jezebel had said to them. So they were participants in this murder because they feared Jezebel not too much to carry it out. And as it was written in the letters that she had sent to them here in verse 12, they proclaimed the fast. The two came and lied about Naboth.
And they killed him. Verse 15. And it came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned. Now, for a second, let's go back up to verse 14. Again, were they fooled? Not a chance. They knew it wasn't Ahab sending those letters. Verse 14. Then they said to Jezebel, saying, Naboth is stoned and is dead. So again, they knew who sent this order, even if it did have Ahab's name on it. But they feared her. Her lust, her selfishness, her lying, her stealing eventually led to murder. So we can see what something potentially, seemingly innocent has turned out to be. Verse 15. And it came to pass then, when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive, but dead. And you think he's going to say, For me? You know? What? How did that happen? He knew. He knew that Naboth just didn't have a heart attack or whatever. He knew. He knew that Naboth, that something happened to him, and he allowed her to work this scheme to help, again, to gratify himself, to get what he wanted. And finally, verse 16, and it came to pass when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Again, as if somehow he was an innocent party, which of course he wasn't. So this is just one example, and we could again spend hours just going through our Bible looking at other examples of selfishness, self-centeredness, this lust for things. But President Woodrow Wilson once said this, and I really like this saying. He said, if you think about what you ought to do for other people, your character will take care of itself. Let me repeat that. If you think about what you ought to do for other people, your character will take care of itself. And again, that's contrary to how we're born. You know, the name of the sermon is, Hey, that's mine! You know, that whole inherent concept we have to take care of ourselves. When we're young, you remember the fighting, you know, over certain things. You didn't want to play with that toy until they did. And then, that's mine. It's that selfishness that we're born with, that we fight with all our life. Let's ask this question. What would you say about a person who is busy in his or her own selfish life? How would you think they might respond, he or she respond to others? Well, they might be thoughtless. They might be selfish. They might be self-centered. A person who's caught up in this might be too busy to listen or too busy to help lend a helping hand or to give support. This person might be insensitive. They might be cruel, say cruel things. They might just be mean. This person might be unthankful. They might be ungrateful for everything or anything that they have. And if you think about that, that's unfortunately becoming kind of typical mentality of our society. Turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3, if you would, please. Speaking of ungrateful, I would be come across as ungrateful if I didn't thank us for the special music, which, by the way, was very, very pleasing. So thank you very much for your hard work. Very nice piece. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Starting in verse 1. Again, talking about the typical mentality of our society, in verse 1 of 2 Timothy 3, But know this, it says, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers,
It goes on to say, they'll be disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving. It says they'll be slanderers without self-control. They'll be brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. From such, turn away. We, all of us, are in this world every day, at work or whatever. We drive around, we see things, we listen to the news, we listen to the radio, we read the newspapers. That's happening out there. It's everywhere that we look. So many people are in this for just what I can get out of it now. And we can think of the extreme examples that we hear about in the news that we see in a workplace. But could we ever start taking on some of these tendencies? We could. And I think we do at times, because we are inherently self-centered as a people. And Satan wants us to have some of these traits. Just look at the gangs around, or the terrorists that commit some atrocities with no feeling whatsoever. They have no emotional connection, no emotional response, no caring for others. But people of character are very different than what we described here in 2 Timothy 3. A person who truly cares feels an emotional response to both the pain and the joy of others. You and I were hand-selected by God to think and to live as caring people, children of a loving, caring Father. Turn back to Colossians chapter 3, please. Colossians chapter 3. One of my friends before services asked me what I was speaking about, and I told him, and she said, "Do you know anything about that topic?" And I says, "Unfortunately, I do. I do know much about this topic, and I don't want to know so much." But Colossians 3, verse 12. This is how we're supposed to act as children of that loving and caring Father. It says, "Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do." And as Mr. Kaczynski talked about in his fine sermonette, "But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection." God tells us how we're supposed to behave. He says, don't do this. This is how I want you to act. This is how a person of character acts. This is how someone who I've called, who has my Holy Spirit, this is how I expect them to behave. We need to understand that's contrary to human nature. Human nature is self-centered rather than God-centered. Remember what it says in Romans 8:7? You can write that down, Romans 8:7. It says, "Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be." And we all have our own healthy doses of human nature. And we have to be careful again, because human nature, this self-centeredness, can blind us to the causes and the effects of our words and of our actions. We become oblivious to how we interact with other people. It can block our sensitivities to the pain that we inflict on others. When we just think about, understand what I'm going through. And maybe someone else is going through the same thing or something worse. You see, it's not about me. It's not about just you. Turn back to Galatians chapter 5. Because our Bible expresses an enormous scope of abusive thoughts and actions. It tells us about the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, verses 19 and through 21. Galatians 5, starting in verse 19, it says, "Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath." Some of those guys on the road were really bad, though. But I won't think about that. I don't need the veins to pop out of my forehead again. "Selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in times past, that those who practice such things will not." That's the word. If you practice these things, you will not inherit the kingdom of God. And we understand that this is a really broad brush that's painted here, but we also understand how easy it is for us to sin, and we all sin, and we fall back into some of these traits that we've had in the past. But God tells us, don't do it, because if you don't overcome these things, you won't be in the kingdom of God. We have to understand that it comes down to controlling our thoughts and our emotions, because that's what produces our actions. And I don't want to downplay, you know, thoughts and feelings and emotions, because they play an important role in our lives. Our feelings connect with our thoughts, and once that's happened, then we have an emotion. Emotions are formed, and I have some folks that I work with. You know, I work with adults with disabilities, and a lot of them have the same issues going on in life that we do. But so many times over the last 28 years, I'd have a participant come into work, and maybe they had a bad day or bad night at home, or they got in an argument with their staff or their boyfriend, and they come into work, and they're frustrated. And so many times I'll have staff say, "That was home, this is work, forget about it." Come on. That's hard for any of us to do, right? You can't just turn your mind off and say, "Oh yeah, that argument I just had when I got out of the van with someone, I won't think about that for 8 more hours." It's not real life. And emotions, what I tell the staff is, emotions are a good thing. That's how we bring about change in our lives. We have to teach people how to handle their emotions, how to express them in an appropriate way. See, God could have created us without emotions. We could be intelligent, calculating, insensitive machines. But He didn't. That's not what He wanted for us. Think about how exceedingly dull life was be. That's not how we were created. God created us and has given us an astonishing capacity for emotion that can show itself in seemingly unending combinations of types and intensities. And even the same situation doesn't strike us the same every time, because maybe it was hotter this day and we were too hot, or we were too cold, or we just had this happen to us. So it's just this infinite amount of combinations the way that our emotions can come across. And again, I mentioned that sometimes emotions and feelings are often viewed in negative terms. And those emotions and feelings, the emotions aren't negative. It's, again, how we deal with them, the actions that come out of them, how we handle them, how we move on that affect our lives. And it's interesting that science is really only beginning to maybe scratch the surface in understanding that the whole emotional component of our mind. And they're trying to create a scientific model, if you will, that explains so much of, or explains the I'll read this so I get it right. It explains, it tries to explain why we do what we do and how that is emotionally driven. And again, I think they're probably going to strike out on that because, again, emotions are not something you can calculate from a machine. If you think back in Proverbs 23, verse 7, I start talking about emotions and how we react and how we think. I think of Solomon at times because Solomon was so insightful. And we understand he had just incredible wisdom granted to him by God. But we start thinking about our emotions and how our emotions can lead to feelings and how our feelings then lead to actions. Solomon reminds us in Proverbs 23, verse 7, he says, he reminds us that as he, a man, thinks in his heart, so he is. So those feelings, those emotions, those feelings, and then those subsequent actions and what we dwell on and what we think about drives how we interact with others, drives how we meet challenges head on. And we understand that as Solomon did, he sought godly wisdom at least fairly early on in his tenure there. And we understand we need to do the same. Proverbs 19:8 says, "He who gets wisdom loves his own soul. He who keeps understanding will find good food." So let's talk just a little bit for a few minutes about some specific areas in our lives where we can apply this concept that I've been talking about. And let's look at some areas where we can see, if we're honest, how selfishness can cause or at least maybe exacerbate a problem. And let's pick one that we all are working on getting better at every day, and that's just relationships. You see, many a relationship has been squandered or ruined because of selfishness. And whether it be at work, whether it be church, home, it doesn't matter. We've all had to deal with relationships problems. And maybe it's a matter of just misunderstanding sometimes. But sometimes we're so overwhelmed by another's sense of self-centeredness that it bothers us because it clashes with our own. How many times have I said it in my life when someone, I get annoyed at someone and somebody says, "Why are you so annoyed? I just don't like that. You know, I don't like it. It made me uncomfortable. I didn't get to do what I wanted. It kind of threw me off kilter." Maybe we get put out because someone doesn't see it our way or doesn't acknowledge our stance or our point of view. That happens. Or what about those times when someone makes a decision that we wouldn't have made and we get disgusted with them? Think about it, though. Why? Why do we get disgusted with them? Because we didn't get what we wanted? And I'm boiling that down to very basic. Understand, there are a lot of nuances involved. But really, why would a decision we didn't really like, we get disgusted. Why? Because we didn't go the way I wanted it to. Right? Maybe their decision inconvenienced or messed up some plans that you've been making or that you had. Maybe your decision was going to mess up their plans if things would have went your way. You see, we need to remember that we're to follow Christ's example of how he treated others. We need to learn to appreciate others' differing talents and their gifts. Hebrews 12:14. Well, let's turn there. Hebrews 12, verse 14. It says, "Pursue peace with everyone and holiness, for without it, no one will see the Lord." Pursue peace with everyone and holiness, for without it, no one will see the Lord. That's a tough thing to do day in and day out. As much as we say we're God's people, as much as I think we are, we still struggle. Do we always live up to what it says here? You see, it's that whole self-centered issue that gets in our way in our relationships sometimes. And this week I had a situation where staff came to me and they said, would you go talk to Robert again? Robert keeps giving his lunch away and he's a severe diabetic. And he knows, Robert's pretty sharp. So I go talk to Robert and I say, Robert, you know you can't give your lunch away. You have to eat. And he'll say, well, Bob didn't, or whoever, he didn't bring his lunch. He was hungry. I said, I understand, but we'll help him. I see this on a regular basis. This people I work with, this selflessness. They give away their coat, their shoes, their mittens, their lunch. And I hear people say, well, they just don't know any better. They do, in a lot of cases. They know a lot better than we do. They see somebody in need, and they give them whatever they have. They put those people ahead of themselves. And I'm humbled every day by what I see. I saw a story, and you probably have seen it before too. There's just recently, there was a young fella with a severe disability who always had a dream to play baseball. And his team was playing against another competing school. And they had allowed him to even wear a jersey and come and, you know, be a part of the team. But he wanted to play so bad. And it was a big game. And it got right towards the end of the game. It was getting right down to it. And it was neck and neck. And the players kept seeing this little fella that he wanted to play. And he kept going to the coach. And he's like, this is a big game. Coach finally relented. It was down to the last out. There were people on base. This was their chance to win it. But he put in this young disabled man. And you would think the other team, again, this is high schoolers, you would think they're going to have a feast on this. The other team, the pitcher, walked up closer. And he tossed the ball softly. And the guy didn't really know how to swing a bat. He swung and he missed it. So he walks up a little bit closer, and you think now the fans and the rest of the teammates are going to be saying, what are you doing? We have a chance. He walks up a little closer, and he tosses the ball, and the guy just happens to get his bat in front of the ball, and he hits it back to the pitcher. And now everybody in the stands, even the other team, saying, run, run! And the pitcher picks up the ball, and he throws it way over the first baseman's head. And so he keeps running. He goes to second. The first baseman throws it over the second baseman's head. All the way around, he made it in home plate. Officially, they won. The other team had a chance to go on to whatever it was, sectionals, was out. They were done for the year. But there was not one person on that team that regretted, in this case, throwing the game because of what it meant to this one individual. And I'm very touched by that because, again, in high school sports, it's very competitive. And this was a big deal for these schools. He was the hero. They made his day. They made his, he'll never forget that situation. And you know what? I bet that opposing team will never, ever forget that situation either. They did something very, very good that day. Reminds me of Matthew 5, if you want to turn back there, please. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5, starting in verse 43. We talk about this, our relationships and serving others, loving our neighbor. It says in Matthew 5, 43, it says, you've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you in verse 44, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be like your Father in heaven, since he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Verse 46, for if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Even the tax collectors do the same, don't they? Verse 47, and if you only greet your brothers, what more do you do?
Even the Gentiles do the same, don't they? Finally, verse 48. So then, he says, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. That's how we're supposed to deal with those people around us. And I'm not saying it, you know, there are people out there that say, oh, you just wait. United's going to be turning the over leaf. We're going to just let everybody come in. We're going to ignore their sins. We're going to become just ultra liberal. And we're going to just turn our eye to the sins because we just want to grow the numbers. It's not saying that. It's not saying to hate the sin. It's not saying to ignore it. It's telling us how to treat others in general. What about just serving others? True servant leadership is about serving others. It goes completely against selfishness. You see, to be a true servant leader, which God requires of us all, requires us all to be, we have to develop several characteristics. Things like a true attitude of humility. We have to develop a willingness to truly listen to others, not just hear their words and wait for them to pause so we can interject what we want to say. We have to develop an ability to empathize with the needs of others, not, oh, they got what they deserved. We have to develop a commitment to seeing that the needs of others are met whenever possible. I'm working on developing those qualities. What about you? Do you have those? Do you put the feelings of others ahead of yours? You see, human nature's selfishness prohibits us, for the most part, from being godlike in our actions. And I'm going to guess that every day, each and every one of us struggles with this to a point. The urge to take care of me, the urge to self-preserve, is a powerful thing. It's going to show itself many times during the course of the day in all of us. It's just a fact. We have to overcome. We have to work to overcome that. And recognizing for what it is. Is how we first the first step we have in overcoming that. I think about serving others. We're not very far. We're a month away from the Feast of Tabernacles. We're all making our plans and where we're going to stay. And many people are also saying, you know, I'm going to this spot and this spot, and I want to do this and I want to do this. And there's nothing wrong with that, per se. But what about, instead of doing all the things I want to do at the feast, what about seeing what we can do to make someone else's feast a little more special? I was talking with some friends of mine, and they're going to Alaska as well, along with the Schmitz. And they were saying, you know, there's a lady going with us, and oh, she really wants to go on this boat ride, but she just can't afford it. And then as they said this, they looked at each other and they said, we're going to make sure she gets to go. We're going to give her a ride to go there. And that's an easy one. It's easy to give some money. Hey, you need some money to go do this. But what about taking somebody out? Spending the time with them, not just saying, you know, they're short on cash, here's $100. Have a ball. Do something with them. Do what you can to make their feast special. Be a true servant. Mark 10, verse 45. It says, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Author Paul Moody said this. He said, the measure of a man is not the number of his servants, but the number of people whom he serves. Peter Drucker said this, no leader is worth his salt who won't set up chairs. I like that one. But what about just basic choices that we make? You know, we make countless choices every day. And I'd ask you over this next week to consider this. With every choice that you make this week, every opportunity to have to say, I'm going to go this direction or I'm going to go this direction,
Ask yourself what your motive for that decision is. So every choice you make this week, ask yourself when you make that decision, what your motive for your decision is. Now, understand that just if your answer is just because I want to, that's not necessarily bad. If you decide I want to have an omelet, three-egg omelet with something, that's not necessarily a bad decision. So don't take it that way. But just because I want to can be, of course, if the decision's based upon that The decisions based upon just because that's what I want to do can be negative if they have a negative impact on others. Again, as human beings, we're selfish. And I think that you're going to as you do this, you're going to see how many irritations that you endure that are a result of someone else's selfishness clashing with our own. It happens every day. You see, every choice that we make is either taking us closer or farther away from something. And unfortunately, oftentimes those choices are taking us farther away from the way from God and the way that He wants us to expect. And obviously, then there are the consequences. The obvious consequences, or the obvious consequence for choosing to sin, God tells us the reward for sin is death. Your choice to eat foods that are bad for you or even just overeating might cause health issues, but they may not necessarily be sin. But we need to understand that everything we do, every decision we make, has a reaction, a consequence. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Our choices lead to good consequences or bad. And we understand, though, that God has given us the tools to make wise decisions at all times. And we need to use them. Isaiah 30, verse 21, you could turn there if you'd like. We're just going to read one scripture. But it reminds me of this is every day when you're approaching some of those more critical decisions and you think to yourself, now, I'm not sure how to handle this. What should I do? And maybe you say you pray about it. Isaiah 30, verse 21. I'm not saying you're going to hear this voice, but you know, at times you know the right thing to do, even if we don't do it. It says, you'll hear a word spoken behind you saying, this is the correct way. Walk in it. See, we many, many times, most times, when we make a decision, even if it's the wrong one, it's not that we didn't know what was right. It's just that we chose to do what we wanted to at that time. What about this area of our life? What about pride? That one's a little painful. I had a situation where my board president, actually this week, we had a miscommunication. He called and he was screaming at me. And then I was trying to talk to him and he's screaming and he hung up. And I was mad. I was still mad when I went home. And so Brenda's doing what wonderful things that wives often do, where she's talking me through it. And she's like, I'm really sorry you feel that way. But can you just let it go? Forget it. And I said, you know, I wish I could. But I can't. This really irritates me. We had a wonderful talk. And finally she said, you know, this might make you mad, but I don't understand why it make you mad. Is it hurt your pride? I went, oh, I think so. I think that's what it did. That's why I was so mad. He hurt my pride. It's, you know, we do that. It happens to us. It hurts. It's painful. How dare they do that? We understand that pride in us can be a killer, literally. But understand that self-preservation, that self-absorbed side of us, you know, thinks that, hey, we're doing a pretty good job. We're pretty handsome. We wear bow ties. Oh, no, maybe not bow ties. Not bow ties. I'm sorry. We're pretty knowledgeable. We're unflappable. You know, we're humble.
You name it. And when someone does or says something that hurts, that shows us maybe they may not show us in such a favorable light, it hurts. Has it happened to you? Have you ever been put down or slighted? Sure you have. Have you ever put down or slighted someone else? You probably have. But again, it's that self-centered way of thinking, that pride in this particular case that can cause us issues. Let's spend just a couple minutes looking quickly at some other areas that might trip us up, and understand that as we look at them, if we really think about it, and you can write these down as we just quickly look at it, that as we peel back all the layers of the onion, that sometimes it's just selfishness that causes us issues in these things. It's about, when it's all about us. Again, what about, well, we'll do an obvious, we talked about it already, what about adultery, fornication? Think about that. What's the purpose? Is it the thrill, the emotional, or the physical rush that we feel, or that someone feels? Yeah. Or is it about putting someone else's feelings before your own? No, it's about indulging the senses, right? It's about you, making you feel good at the time. Or anger. There are times when anger is justified. Now, when people are driving like maniacs and they're not endangering my life, maybe it's not justified. But if we're honest, you know, anger usually comes back, you know, to being my issue. Someone did something I didn't like. Someone slighted me. I didn't like what they said. I didn't like the way they looked or whatever. Anger is often based on selfishness. What about our attitude in general? Our attitude is controlled by our thoughts, right? You know, I can convince myself when I get up in the morning that I'm going to have a good day or bad day. Walk out of the room, the dog had an accident on the floor. Oh, that's my whole day's shot. Or I can cover it up with the rug and let Brenda discover it later and be fine with it. I wouldn't do that. We don't have rugs. So, but the decisions are all too often based upon our outlook, right? If I have to do something I don't want to do, or I have to deal with someone else who's exhibiting a selfish behavior, it irks me. It affects my attitude. But again, attitude is something that I have complete control over. I decide how my day is going to be. I decide how I'm going to act with someone. I decide. I don't let other people decide my attitude. We could talk about drug abuse. That's an easy one. Why do people take illicit drugs? For the rush, to feel good. Even if they don't want to, you know. Sometimes they just can't help but not do that. They get addicted at times. But early on, it's about me. I want that. It makes me feel good. A couple others. Gossip. Really, what purpose does gossip serve, right? At times it can be used to make ourselves look better. Hey, I knew about this. Or maybe it's just because we're nosy. We want to know. Is it our business? No, but we like to know. We like to know the scoop because, well, we just want to. Again, it's a self-serving thing. What about lying? Again, what purpose does it serve? To get us out of trouble? Maybe. Temporarily? If so, it's still about me. Is it to make ourselves look better? Again, about me. To have someone leave us alone? About me. You see, lying serves no other purpose other than selfishness. We could talk about divorce and how often, many times, divorce can be traced back to one or both parties' selfishness and their unwillingness to change their ways. And again, I'm just kind of glossing over the top. There are a lot of issues that get involved, but we could go through countless incidents
and oftentimes see that it comes down to the fact that everyone says, it's about me. And that's not always the case. Please understand that. There are safety issues and lots of things involved. But usually with one side or the other, it is about me. One more, financial difficulties. Financial difficulties are not always the result of selfishness, but oftentimes it's the case. People living way beyond their means. All the subprime mortgages, you know, people buying mortgages a lot more than they could afford. And then when push came to shove, they couldn't pay for it. They needed that new house, that new boat, that new car, that whatever, and they couldn't afford it. But it was about me. I want that. You have that. Why can't I have that? You know, we could go on and on with good examples of ways that our own selfishness and our own self-centered approach at times bring on hardships in our life. But what I hope this afternoon is that we all realize that that's not God's way. While it's true we were born with that tendency, that's not what God wants us to be. See, we have to realize and admit that just how often we get in our own way. Just how often we're the cause of a lot of our own troubles. We have to realize that we do live in the me point of view, and we have to learn to change our way of thinking. And again, it's going to be difficult because that goes against human nature. That goes against that inborn need for self-preservation. The trick, though, is balance. The ability to balance our needs. Not wants, first of all, but the ability to balance our needs with the needs of others. It's about balance. And obviously, this will require a new approach to how we think about others and how we treat others. Are you up to that task? Are you ready to put your own self-centered inner self to the side and begin to think and act like our ultimate example, Christ? To think and act like our Creator in whose image we were created? It's going to be hard. It's going to be a tough journey, but we're here. We understand it today. We've talked about it a little bit. We have a little insight into ourselves and understand that this can be an issue. So now's the time to start. You see, God did not create anyone to be bad or evil. We, you and I, alone make the choice to be either good or to be bad. Are you ready to make that choice, to make that big leap from selfishness to selflessness?